We're looking at his graduate rate.
Okay. So he's...
Okay. We have the course, essentially, but it's CO's, 6X, IO's, 6X, or whatever it is. I can't remember the number. So we just only want to sort of core centralize them and give them a system. Revenue always, all those courses comes back to the college of the way.
So it would make it easier for us to do that than
right.
to cross.
Yeah, now it might, we had some school fish people doing it, but it could be UNSM and SFOS or whatever they they're just.
Quit
why we worried about.
Hi.
Having that designator would allow me
good,
to
how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Yes.
More cross people. Okay, so Laura Connor's working on that.
Yeah,
part of the request.
It's similar to what we just did. We created a code for
IRSA.
Yeah. We created a designator for women.
Right. So I wasn't worried. I wasn't sure if there was a separation of codes. But
well,
it could be an issue down the road.
I guess. Inspection of the catalog.
Okay, good. Well, we'll do that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, but what kind of math is that? Is it just pure math, or is it?
I'm bringing out the first two pages. Pick up the rest of the guy.
Yeah, that's awesome.
How are you?
Coming up.
Yeah. Same here.
What I've been doing is sending
a
letter to the chairman.
They have seen a bundle of clothing.
Yeah, which is, you know, it's really important to inform
how you put the butter in there.
Because for the very good clothing, I just simply let the chairman know.
And that's why we send those lists.
Did anyone?
Yep. I sent all those out for everybody.
Actually,
just tracking those four lists.
Thank you.
She usually puts her name
like
right now, the trends aren't very positive.
Yes. So there are two restrictions about where to sit. You can't sit up at the head table because that's for the important people. And then they try to keep a seat open at the corner for public testimony. Those are the only two
restrictions. Yeah, those are the letters that are
okay. Well, you know, for Chancellor, Provost,
faculty
senate president, and vice for
president
elect.
He didn't work down there on parking.
I'm going to give you your sign.
I know I've struck out twice, but I've
been talking with my dean.
Whenever I come up here, I don't have it, but
I overrode some of it. Once the member.
Front lot, it's the little tiny one in front or near the library.
Wait a minute.
Oh, yeah, right in front of the Simon's Hall.
We already did that.
Library's there in Simon's Hall, yeah.
Oh, those are
the ones. Which one talks about in front of Simon's
Hall?
2 hours.
Yeah,
we
have
to go back to
what's left. I'll tell you a little secret.
Come from the land. Can you say it?
in the heart.
Transfer station. Yeah, we don't.
Work on desperately. Matt, how about you?
That's a drug system.
I'm trying to find that.
That's a drug system.
Thank you so much.
You're all happy because.
I know. Well, yeah, I am. I got food.
We're all like, where? What are you talking about?
Oh, wow. How did your glass get?
That looks good.
I was saying a new button.
Everybody, let's grab your coffee and mosey on up to the table. Those of you who haven't checked it out, there's coffee and water and warm cookies.
Who do we thank for that?
What?
Who do we thank for that?
Thank Jane.
Thank you, Jane.
Jane. Thank
she
you,
who
Jane.
Does many wondrous things. So, let's go ahead and call the meeting to order. Jane, could you do a roll call, please?
Okay. Abramowitz.
Here.
I said that wrong. I'm sorry. Alexia.
Here.
Arendt. Bake.
Here.
Baker.
You're in for Baker.
Hi. Yeah.
Oh, okay. We have June Motabe for Carrie Baker. Bandopadhyay.
Yes.
Barbosa. Bret Hart.
Here.
Brown.
Here.
Okay. Audio. Cahill.
Here.
Davis.
Here.
Fallon. George Bettisworth.
Here.
Golux.
Here.
Gustafson.
Here.
Healy.
Here.
Henry.
Here.
Himmelblum.
Here.
Horstmann.
Here.
Jensen.
Here.
Johnston.
Here.
Jolie. Jones.
Here.
Lardon. Anyone here for Cecile Lardon? Lawler.
Here.
Mathis.
Here.
McCackern.
Here.
Metzger. Anyone here for Andrew Metzger? Mayor.
Here.
Moses. Anyone here for Deborah Moses? Nadine. Elizabeth Nadine? Newberry.
Here.
Chung Sang. Radenbaugh. He was weathered in Dillingham. Rennes.
Christine Cook for Sue.
Okay, Christine Cook for Sue. Reynolds. Short.
Here.
Valentine.
Here.
Weber.
Here.
Winfrey.
Here.
Audio. I heard you on audio.
Yes, I am.
Zhang. Okay, and let me recognize our non-voting members. Let's see, Registrar Mike Ernest.
Here.
And do we have Melanie Arthur from United Academics? And Paul Lair.
Here.
Okay, Anita Hartman. Sydney's office. And of course, we have Provost Tenrix and Vice Provost Dana Thomas.
And Dean Lair.
And Dean.
Here. Teresa John.
Hi, Teresa. Got you down. Thank you.
That's for Todd.
And Eric Madsen. Okay. I think I got everyone.
All right. Has everyone had a chance to look at the meeting minutes for meeting 179? Are there any additions or changes? We have any objections to approving the minutes?
Approve them.
All right. Hearing that, let's go ahead and approve the minutes and adopt the agenda. Are there any changes people would like to make to today's agenda? Hearing none, we'll stick with this agenda. That moves us to the status of the Chancellor's Office actions. The Chancellor's Office approved our motion to approve a certificate in baking and pastry arts, and the motion to amend the title of the General Education Objectives and Student Learning Outcomes motion of May 2nd, 2011. So we have nothing pending at the moment, so we're clear as far as the Chancellor's Office is concerned. And that brings us to President's remarks. We've got a lot of stuff going on. Next week is a Board of Regents meeting here on the Fairbanks campus. So it's something that we'd encourage faculty to go see how things are run. And you know, it's always good to let people know good things we're doing. And usually, if you can hit, you know, breakfast or lunch, it's pretty good. But we definitely would like to, you know, let people know that we're doing good things and we're doing a good job. Anchorage did a very nice job of really lining up a bunch of people to say how good they are. We're not necessarily going to follow in their shoes, but it's a good thing to get there, talk to members of the Board of Regents, and it's also a good opportunity to meet a bunch of the administrators if you have not. So I would encourage you to attend. It's a very, very educational experience. the listening sessions. We have a bunch of listening sessions that are internal that are going on now. Valentine's Day is the listening session at the main UAF campus. February 16th will be CTC. February 21st is Kutskukwim. February 28th is Northwest. This is an opportunity for us to get our voices heard in terms of internal listening sessions. They're separating out faculty, staff, and student listening sessions. Gives us an opportunity to say what's going well with the university, what would we change, you know, what can we do better, and get us as faculty heard in this process. So I encourage you to make it to the listening sessions. Look at the schedule, find out when there happens to be one near you, and attend if at all possible. Other things, the eLab Task Force met, and they're working on their recommendations, and we'll get them to you as we go through, as they go through Faculty Alliance in terms of getting our blessing to get, you know, pass through and get comments in from you guys. What we really want to say is thank you to the participants, and especially Orion, Rich Collins, Reiner. They went and, from what I understand, were very, very productive, and we appreciate the effort they put in. So stay tuned. You guys will be getting a draft at some point to look at and comment. And so, again, thank you very much for taking the time to sit down with the folks from UAS and UAA to work on how we're going to deliver distance labs. Other things, and this is something that Mike Ernest can correct me if I blow something on. The registrars got together and talked about issues across the three MAUs and, you know, what the thoughts were from Board of Regents and others in terms of what do we need to do to tackle the transferability problem. And so there were some things in there that I just want to give you guys a heads up that might be coming. Some of the discussion included things like common general education requirements, common grading systems. Two MAUs are on plus and minus, one is not. Common numbers for courses is something that Board of Regents is pushing. So this is something to pay attention to. A lot of places we're aligned, but other places we aren't. This is going to be an ongoing discussion in terms of the whole transferability issue and making the university appear very attractive and easy to navigate for students. One of the things that we have been given grief on by one legislator is, well, you don't do enough for military. Well, after the report from various people at this university, they backed off that one because it turns out we are doing a very good job in terms of trying to get military credit accepted here. So congratulations to the people who made the argument that we are doing a good job. The last thing I have here is in terms of Faculty Alliance, we're looking at Stay on Track and America Completes. I know that we as faculty have issues with some of these in terms of how they were rolled out, who they're for, and what we're signing up for if we contribute to America Completes. So in your committees, look at these particular programs, see how they would potentially influence faculty, and if you have any comments on what you think is good, what you don't think is good, if you can get comments into me, I would really appreciate that. It's something where I really want to be able to say the faculty at UAF think this is a good idea or this is a bad idea. So talk about it in your committees, and if you come up with some, you know, things about this is a problem because of X, Y, and Z, please let me know. So those are all the topics I had. Any questions?
Could you restate when the Board of Regents meeting is?
Board of Regents meeting is next week, Wednesday and Thursday.
And when's the free food?
First thing in the morning and lunchtime. All right. That I'll hand it over to Jennifer.
Thank you, Kathy. I have two topics to bring to your attention. One is that elections for next year's Faculty Senate are coming up soon. The memos from the Faculty Senate office will go to the deans and directors. They're the offices that actually run your elections. However, it's the faculty nominate senators for these elections, and you should be looking for communications from your deans and directors about nominations. We're asking that those elections be concluded by the end of March. So they'll be happening in the next few weeks. The other is the election for next year's president-elect of the Faculty Senate, will be coming up. We will ask for nominations beginning at the March meeting of the Faculty Senate, and nominations will be open all the way up to the election, which will be at the April meeting of the Faculty Senate. And back to Kathy. Thank you. Any questions for Jennifer?
And I encourage all of you, if you are interested in the position of president-elect, it is an interesting position. You learn a tremendous amount about how this university works and get you some very, very good connections with the powers that be. So definitely think about it, and if you have an interest, let one of us know. And with that, we'll go ahead and we'll postpone the chancellor's remarks since he's not here at the moment and go to the provost's remarks. Susan?
Good afternoon, everyone. Is this, yeah, I think I can hear it working. First of all, I want to add a little bit to what Kathy said about the Board of Regents meeting. You can find an agenda for the Regents meeting on the statewide website. Just go to the main page of statewide and look for a link to Board of Regents, and under that link, there'll be access to the agenda. And one reason that that's important is that there is public testimony each day that the Regents are in session. It's usually at 9 or 10 a.m., but I'm not positive about this particular meeting and what time it will be. And that gives anyone who wishes to speak a three-minute window to talk, so you have to be concise. I wouldn't encourage dozens of people saying the same thing, and they're not usually looking for generic faculty input at that time, because, you know, just things like, I'm from the theater program, and the theater program is wonderful. You can do that because it's a free speech situation, but it isn't particularly impressive. If you have an exciting new project or something really interesting that you would like to tell them about, recent student successes or something like that, that's the sort of thing that tends to catch their attention. One other thing, though, is what really catches their attention, kind of like with the legislature, is if some satisfied served person comes and talks, either a couple of your current students or someone from the community that graduated from your program and is having an exciting, successful career because of that. Along those lines, that is often very effective in getting our points scored with the Board of Regents. We don't want to monopolize the public testimony, though, is the other thing, because they do want to let any community members that want to talk have their opportunity. So if you see a lot of community members there to talk, you might want to tone down your remarks to a bare minimum. Okay, moving on to the specifics of what I wanted to talk about today. You may think this is winter, and it certainly seemed like winter last week, but it's really budget season. And budget season has many facets. One is, of course, the university's budget is being considered in the legislature, and some of you may be involved with one or more of the requests and may be asking to help, maybe being asked to help build support for it in various ways. Unfortunately, the governor didn't put any of the university's new requests in his recommended budget, but it seems to be the opinion of the upper administration that he did that because he expects the legislature to fund some things, but he wants it to be the legislature's choice. So it's our job to convince appropriate legislators that some of our requests are worthy of support. The other aspects of budget season, though, are more close to home and more work for all of us, and that is to gather the requests and evaluate them for both the FY13 PBB internal reallocations, and remember those tend to be in amounts on the order of 100,000 to a few hundred thousand in size at most, because the total PBB allocation pool is only $1.7 million roughly, and also the new requests potentially to be submitted to the legislature for FY14. Those tend to be larger requests of at least $100,000, but up sometimes to as much as $1 million in unusual circumstances, although $500,000 seems to be kind of a round number that many of these come in at.
There will be a process. You should hear about it from your dean or director very shortly. There'll be a request for budget items for either of those two categories, or sometimes people submit to both. This year, something different based on the recommendations we received after the accreditation site visit, and that is that we need to tie in our budgeting processes to the accreditation core themes objectives. So we have identified, and you've seen as we discussed our accreditation process, a variety of objectives for the universities. Those are going to be refined a bit during this year, but they're going to be fairly similar, I think, going forward. And we are going to ask from each unit that submits budget requests to relate their request to those core themes and indicators, and particularly core themes and objectives, and particularly to improvement on the indicators of improvement that we have established. And then ultimately, because part of looking good on the accreditation process is for everyone to understand how the budget requests relate to the core themes and indicators, my office will send back a short report to the faculty, probably through the Faculty Senate and through other communication avenues, that will kind of tie the knot and show you how the eventually selected budget reallocations or budget requests do relate to the objectives that have been identified as the university. That will be a challenge, and establishing priorities within a set of how many objectives are there? 19?
19.
Yeah, that's right. Within a set of 19 objectives will be a challenge, but that's the challenge for this spring. So I'd be happy to answer any questions about the budget process as we go forward. If you have any questions now, or you can always email or call me, or slip a note under my door, or other means of communication accepted.
No questions for Susan, and let's go ahead and hear from Vice Provost Thomas.
Thank you. Sounds like this one's working as well, huh? Good. I want to start off by thanking the Core Revitalization Committee. They're making good progress. They've considered a handful of example new core curriculum. So I'll ask you all to thank Alex Fitz for chairing that committee and all of the members of that committee, some of whom are here, and take part in that work, stay involved. I want to tell you a little bit about the January 11th commission meeting, Northwest Commission on Colleges and Universities, our Institutional Accrediting Association. Chancellor and the Provost and I were there with the commissioners, quite an experience. 24 commissioners. We walk in and they grill us for about an hour about why we're not doing better at our assessment. Okay? So I wanted you to hear that. And so you can expect to hear from us on the quality of our outcomes assessment processes, just effectively sharing the joy in that wonderful experience. I guess I'll remind you all, I've brought it up before, that this pressure's being on outcomes assessment is being passed along effectively by the commission because the federal government would really like to take control of it now and institute a No Child Left Behind Act for higher ed where everybody gets tested. The commission, of course, is fighting that, and their way of fighting it is to press us on student learning outcomes assessment so that if we can prove it ourselves, there won't be a federal mandate for that. All right. So I just want you to understand kind of the political scene that's going on and the kind of impact that occurred at the commission meeting. We're still waiting for our final letter as to when we have to report on the small number of recommendations we received. We received three. One of those was on outcomes assessment. And I wrote to them today because it's a little bit late that we haven't heard by now. Saying, you know, when should we expect that letter? Haven't heard back, but I will share that with Senate leadership as soon as I get it. You'll see motions on the agenda today that I will speak to. One is a revised UAF mission statement. One is on the core themes for accreditation again, and one is on educational effectiveness. So all three before you today, I hope you've had a chance to look at those and talk with your constituents about those proposals. I'll look forward to hearing your thoughts on that when we get to those sections. At the next meeting, I will bring a revised motion on program review and a schedule, a proposed schedule of program review starting next year. So a full process, the template, the instructions, and the evaluation form that the various groups will use for evaluating programs. So you can look forward to that. The last thing I have is Eric Madsen has been working with me and the Faculty Affairs Committee on electronic annual activity reporting software possibilities. We have scheduled three software groups to talk to us and present about their software. We've gone through two of those. One was Data 180 and the second one was FolioTech. Tomorrow at 2, correct me if I'm wrong, Eric, tomorrow at 2 in Greening 718 is Activity Insights, Digital Measures, the one that a few units tried a few years ago. They have significantly revised their program, so we're looking at that again. Of these, of the two that we've looked at so far, I guess I would say that we've pretty much discarded FolioTech because of its weaknesses connecting to other stuff that we do here and other programs we use. Data 180 looks very, very good. Was written by faculty members, used by 40 institutions currently. Very easy, friendly, and collects information the way we normally would collect and report it ourselves in our usual Word document. So it looks very suitable. It connects well with existing software here, so you may be hearing more about that one. But we'll get through the last presentation tomorrow and then get feedback from Faculty Affairs before we move further. Okay? Any questions?
Dana, I've got a question. What were the other two recommendations?
So on accreditation, I'll just run through them. One was connecting planning and budgeting to the themes and objectives more fully. One was assessment. Maybe one was. So was there a separate one for planning and a separate one for budget? I think that's the case. Yeah, so those were the three.
Any other questions for Dana? Nope. Then let's go ahead and move on to new business, motion to define the academic credit hour requirements for laboratory instruction submitted by Curricular Affairs. Reiner?
This is actually fairly on switch here. This is actually fairly straightforward, even though it seems very complicated. Board of Regents has defined one credit as essentially 3 hours of student effort per week for the semester. And our logic for one credit per 1 hour of lecture is that implicitly there are 2 hours of student work outside of the classroom. The problem is the lab business, and gosh, since the beginning of time, or at least since recorded history with cuneiform, science and engineering programs around the world use 3 hours per week per one credit for the entire semester. And for reasons which are not altogether clear, non-science and engineering departments at UAF, arts, culinary arts, auto mechanics, dental hygiene, you name it, use 2 hours per week for the semester for one credit. To bring us in line with the Board of Regents requirement that there be a minimum of three hours of effort per week, essentially, per credit, without causing major restructuring or anything really, we have proposed this amendment to the how credits are divvied up, which says, okay, if you're doing a 2 hour per week per credit lab situation, then you need to have at least 1 hour of student activity outside of lab. Now, the two key pieces here are that we are not planning to go back to every single non-science and engineering lab and say, show us the evidence that there is 1 hour at least of student effort per week outside of the lab. Our policy will be don't ask, don't tell. However, for new courses and change courses which involve the 2 hour per week lab, then we'll be asking for some documentation and in fact there will be student effort outside of the lab per se. So our objective is to get us in line with Board of Regents policies in the least one which causes the least disruption to how we've always done things. Thank you.
Any questions for Reiner? Any discussion? All right. Sounds like there. You guys seem pretty ambivalent about this one, but let's go ahead and vote. All those in favor, say aye.
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 All those opposed, say nay. Any abstentions? All right, the motion passes. And we have been joined by the Chancellor, so let's skip back to Chancellor's remarks. Brian?
Thanks. Good to be here. Apologize. The downtown meeting went a little over time. Legislature's in session. That's always an interesting time for the university. Governor's budget request is pretty minimal for us this year, with essentially half of our funding for pay raises and is it in terms of the governor's funding on the operating budget. I think the good news is that the legislature is actually more pleased with our budget and is making sounds about some increases. Essentially, the message from the legislative fiscal staff was that the Board of Regents held the line on the total request and should be rewarded for so doing, and that the governor's budget doesn't recognize how much we've done in terms of belt tightening. Whether that actually translates into increases in our budget or not remains to be seen. Several pieces of legislation that will affect us. One that's moving quite quickly has to do with credit for military and military transfer credit. I think the good news there is that the legislation asks us to do about half of what we already do for military. We do far more for students than that asks for, and so really minimal impact on any operations. But the issue of transfer credit generally continues to be a significant issue raised in the legislature in the listening sessions that the strategic directions process has laid out. And so I would expect over the next year we're going to have to come up with some initiatives on credit transfer. I think until we actually dive deep into the data to really understand what the issue is and what the complaints are, that is challenging for the administration, whether it's about timeliness of posting or whether it's certain credits don't transfer or they do transfer but they don't count for the programs that people want. Each one of those people label as credit transfer, each one has a different set of issues. Another area that the Board of Regents has been pushing us on is overall risk management and safety. We will be reporting at the Board of Regents meeting next week about what we're doing on the combined heat and power plant to ensure that it keeps operating until we have a replacement plant. And I've appointed a new ad hoc safety committee to look at what we do in terms of safety for people in all circumstances around the university, including lab safety, including general facility safety, to see if we can improve our results there. Finally, you're all invited to a reception at the Chancellor's House this evening, 5:30. Hope to see everybody there, and I'd be glad to answer any questions that people have.
Suzanne?
So with the new power plant, does it look like the legislature prefers to replace the plant, or are they pushing for sort of limping it along a few more years?
We're going through the permitting process for a replacement plant rather than limping along. There are some Band-Aid solutions that get more expensive by the year, and the replacement plant becomes more cost-effective very quickly if we can keep it on track, and that would be with a permit in hand by 2013 and plans completed in late 2014, early 2015, and starting construction in 15 and finishing in 17. That's a rough schedule. If that slips, we have about $30 or $40 million worth of work we have to do on the old plant to keep it alive, which we would then throw away as soon as we finish the new plant. And so we're trying to keep the process going to get there. There are some potential failure points in the old plant that have been identified, and we've been working our way through over the last decade to try to reduce those. And it's pretty remarkable effort, I think, by facilities to keep that 50-year-old plant working as well as it is. You know, it's pretty important for us to make sure that you have heat and lights so you can do your job, and that's something hopefully you never have to worry about, but I do.
Any other questions for the Chancellor? Hearing none, thank you, Brian. And let's go ahead and move on to discussion items. First one is the draft of the new UAF mission statement. Dana?
Thank you. I should have numbered my pages. I think it's on page 5 of your agenda. The Accreditation Steering Committee offers a draft mission statement. One of the two possibilities there are the ones offered up, slight changes. This has been a back and forth discussion with the Chancellor's Cabinet, and so that's part of the reason that there are two proposals here. The current mission statement is given at the bottom of that page just for comparison. I guess the key differences that you will see between the current mission statement and the two offerings are that the old mission statement says more about who we are rather than what we do and why we do it. And the two new ones are more about what we do and why we do it. So at this point, I would ask for your thoughts on the wording, suggestions, et cetera.
Dana, I just had a question on, are we educating students for lifelong learning? Is that the intent of what you're trying to say in the second revised?
So yes, the steering committee liked the addition of lifelong learning because we do a lot of that.
We're educating students. That's what we're doing. That's what we have a lot of people going that are looking for the university as part of their lifelong learning, but I just wonder if that's what those aren't necessarily what we classify as students. So just kind of curious where the modifier lies.
I see. So perhaps move lifelong learning prior to that leading roles, something like that? Is that what you're suggesting?
Asking the question. I don't have any suggestions. But
no.
I'll leave that up to the committee, but I'm just curious if...
Yeah, one of our purposes, according to the steering committee, is to prepare students for lifelong learning. That's their take on it. And you know, local community members are a part of that, whichever community we're talking about where we have campus.
Go ahead, Dave.
I personally like that second one better since it does explicitly bring up education. That's our core mission. I don't know why we would want to not say educate. So that's my vote. That matters.
Sukumar.
So in order to measure the lifelong learning, how you assess it, how you prove that you are doing really doing something? Assessment.
Assessment could be part of it. Some of it could be as simple as the non-degree seeking students that take courses from us and the CES workshops that people attend, cooperative extension and MAP workshops that people attend. Those are by vast majority lifelong learning kind of opportunities.
Lucille?
I agree with David. I think that the word educate is important. To me, the prepare students for career sounds to me a little too much like job training as opposed to higher education.
We do a lot of that. I'll remind you, one of our core themes is prepare, you know, students for careers, so and professions. So that's the motivation for including that.
But it's not our first thing is job training, right? Our first, I mean, our most important thing is still higher education, which means educate. So, yeah, so I agree with Dave on that.
I'll play the devil's advocate. I have my own personal opinion on it, but I would say a lot of the certificate and applied associate programs really is purely about job prep.
Oh, yeah, I know.
So,
right.
And that's about half of our headcount, just so that you understand that.
But that does not fall. That doesn't fall outside the purview of education, though. That's
completely
it still
agreed.
Fits in there. So
completely agree.
Patrick,
just a question. I mean, so the way it's phrased sounds great. It sounds like it's entirely focused at the undergraduate level. Mm-hmm. So, is there really a sense here that the graduate program? Do we think of graduate programs, certainly at the master's level, certainly you can argue that you're preparing students for careers, but a PhD student, is it more about something else? And so it's just a question about whether or not graduate programs are thought about.
Yeah, certainly we have representation from a variety of graduate programs on the Accreditation Steering Committee. That's a great question. You know, can we expand on that in some way? I'll certainly take that back to the committee. If you have thoughts about specific wording, love to have that.
Dana, could you clarify something here? I thought I was reading it differently than what you might have said. When it says educate students for, and one of them being lifelong learning, I thought you were talking about we're educating students to learn how to learn throughout their lives. Not that we provide learning opportunities later on throughout their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Which one are you intending?
Both.
Okay.
I just was giving an example.
Okay. Because the concern I had was assessment as to whether or not our students are able to learn throughout their lives. I mean, it's easy to teach them the facts. It's hard to teach them how to learn to learn. And that'd be my concern on that one.
Yep. Agreed.
I love it. I mean, I like it.
A challenge to assess that part of it, no question.
I would suggest that this mission statement should be readable by somebody who's not familiar with the university. And so the term lifelong learning has become a buzzword in the university system, and it means something to administrators and faculty here. But I'm afraid that people outside will have the same confusion that Ken just had. What does lifelong learning refer to? And so maybe that phrase should either be reconsidered or clarified. The other concern I have here is that the phrasing is educate students for careers. I don't see that as the number one priority of a university. I see this as educating students for life. Not the career is an excellent outcome of education, but I would hate to see the university say that our main mission is to educate students for careers, because I think what we do is broader than that. And I know that you all agree with that, but having careers be the first word after educates suggests to the naive reader that that's what this is about.
Good.
Laura?
And I don't have a quick fix for that, but reading this, it sounds extremely generic. It could be any university, and I think Fairbanks is very unique and very special. And by just putting Circumpolar North in there, it doesn't capture it for me.
I actually do have a really quick fix on the educate student issue. So proposal is educates students, comma, preparing them for careers, leading roles. You know.
Oh, can you repeat that? You faded off.
So currently it says educate students for careers, et cetera. So my proposal is educate students, comma, preparing them for careers.
Or preparing them for life, careers, whatever the list might be.
Preparing them for lifelong learning, careers, et cetera.
Patrick?
I would just put life in there. I like that. Very good. But educate for life, comma. Very good.
That's good. Are we educating students for success in careers, leading roles, and lifelong?
All right. At this point, I think I'm going to go ahead and say, if you've got suggestions, email the committee or send the comments to Dana and think about it. And any comments you come up with, make sure that you pass them on and so the committee can consider them. He has raised some good points.
Good points.
So with that, let's move on to the next discussion item, which is the draft modification to accreditation core themes. Dana, again.
This is on the following page. I'll remind you that in our last report, we had five themes, educate undergraduate and graduate students, discover through research, scholarship, and creative activity, including emphasis on the North and its people, prepare Alaska's career, technical, and professional workforce, connect Alaska Native, rural, and urban communities through contemporary and traditional knowledge, and finally, engage Alaskans via lifelong learning, outreach, and community and economic development. The steering committee and the chancellor's cabinet has agreed to replace the discover theme with the theme research, create and disseminate new knowledge, insight, technology, artistic, and scholarly works with an emphasis on the circumpolar North and its peoples. So any feedback on the themes is welcome.
Any thoughts?
I know that when this came around the last time around, which was before I sat on this august body, there was a lot of discussion within within our peer unit that had to do with making sure that artistic work and creativity was part of what this is. And so I think that part of the decision to go to Discover had to do with acknowledging that. I notice as we go to research, which I believe was one of the candidates last time around, I noticed that artistic and scholarly works are in there, and I guess I would just want to put on the record, please don't let those drop out.
Part of the discussion about this, just to share it, was some faculty have felt that research is something STEM people do, and other stuff is done by others. Okay, and so it was felt like, one of the presentations was, let's see if we can revise that perspective at UAF. Right? Help it be recognized that all of our scholarly work effectively counts as research. So a unifying perception was the motivation here, just so you've heard that.
My recollection of the discussion that we had last time this came to Faculty Senate, actually it came to several meetings in a row as we were bouncing replies back and forth with the steering committee and the chancellor's office. The most strongly held opinion in Faculty Senate then was that we did not want to have different core themes for creativity, for creative activities versus research. We thought that those ought to be in the same one because they were too interrelated and that research faculty are also creative and faculty in the arts are also doing research type activities. So at that time, the Faculty Senate's main point was that these ought to be phrased together. What seems to be changing here is the title of the theme. But it does not look like there's any move to separate them again.
Well, if I could just sort of follow up on that really quickly. No, I think it's great. And the fact that research is defined that way, just on other documents within the university, certainly we talk about research and creative activity as being separate things, for example, that might go in a tenure and promotional file, or separate things that might go in an annual activities report. So as long as it's really clear that we are unifying them for the purpose of this document, and perhaps they, in fact, should be unified in some other definitional way on other documents, I don't know. But that would certainly be something that I know that within our department and peer unit would be appreciated. So.
Thank you.
I don't remember the way the prepare theme was worded last time, but I'm a little concerned about making it so narrow as to say just Alaska's career technical and professional workforce, because I think that, you know, we're sort of identifying ourselves around northern themes. Well, there's a whole circumpolar northern world that includes other countries and other cultures, and I think we have opportunities way beyond Alaska. So it would be, I think it's, we're limiting ourselves too much by focusing too much on Alaska there.
Thank you.
But to play devil's advocate, my reading on all this is that Alaska is in there because we're an Alaska state institution. And
right,
so if we're functioning as a state university, we're educating people to serve or to be part of the state. Is that an accurate statement, Dana?
Yes.
But are we only educating people for the state? Because then we're going to run out of things to do pretty quick.
Well, the first statement is educate undergraduate and graduate students, so that's pretty broad. So the prepare statement only is the only one that applies to Alaska. So education still is very broad, so I'm cool with it.
Ben?
I see a conflict in here between the mission statement and the themes. With the mission statement, little phrase emphasizing circumpolar north and diverse peoples qualifies all of it, teaching, research, and the environment, our engagement. Whereas here, it seems like you're limiting it to one aspect of the themes. And I guess I always have kind of trouble with that phrase, the way it's included in there, because to me, there's circumpolar north and its peoples. But our focus is on more than just those two things. Our focus is on serving the needs of Alaska overall. Now, part of it's the circumpolar north, part of it's the peoples, but there's a lot of very specific things to Alaska that I think are being maybe left out or de-emphasized. To me, it'd be nice if we could expand that circumpolar north and its peoples to focus more on Alaska. Yeah, we do research that benefits the whole world, but we are here to serve the needs of the people of Alaska primarily. That's the emphasis. And do we have benefit to others? Yes, but it goes way beyond the research. It goes to all aspects of this. And including in one line in the themes seems to limit it to the research line only.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Laura?
Well, I just want to bring up the same thing again. So if we make it too generic by taking out Alaska, we become a generic university again. And I would hate to see that.
Anything else? If you come up with some good ideas, go ahead and shoot them to Dana or me, and we'll get them incorporated in the discussion. Thank you, guys. With that, let's move on to the next one, the proposed motion to amend the educational effectiveness policy with draft model assessment templates. Susan and Dana?
And then brief introduction. As Dana and I have been speaking to programs about doing student learning outcomes assessment, and as required by the recommendations that we got through the accreditation process, improving the consistency and completeness of our outcomes assessment processes, one of the comments that we got was that, well, we need more direction, I guess, for lack of a better term. A lot of people are assigned to do assessment the first semester they come here as a faculty member, or after some years perhaps, but not having paid too much attention to assessment and how it's carried out. And so what was suggested to us was that it would be helpful to have some example assessment plans and that to set the expectation that these would be used unless, and this is an important unless a program has specialized accreditation that requires them to do something different, because I would say pretty much without qualification, any specialized accreditation assessment process is going to be fine for UAF. And then the other exception is if you have a really good reason why you don't want to use the example plan. And that could be because you've had an assessment process in place for several years and it's working well for you and you don't want to change. That's a perfectly acceptable reason. But for programs that have never really gotten started with assessment, don't really have any particularly strong feeling about how they should do assessment, we offer these examples as an approach that you could take that will be acceptable to us people overseeing assessment and that we're confident will be acceptable to the Northwest Commission as well if they come, as they certainly will come back and review us again on assessment in a few years. So I'll let Dana describe a little more detail about some of the issues here.
So the educational effectiveness policy has been in place for quite some time. 97, I think, something like that, was the original policy. It's been revised at once since then, if I remember the changes correctly. The change that I am asking for here is on the second page. You'll see it stands out pretty plainly. Used to be we asked for a report every 4 years. We're asking that to change to two. The principal purpose for that proposed change is twofold. One is so that each and every department chair will understand that they have a responsibility for outcomes assessment. Most department chairs are on elected on a two-year cycle. The other motivation is so that we have a sufficient amount of evidence of implementing outcomes assessment over time that our accrediting agency will find it acceptable. Those are the two key reasons. There's one small change at the bottom where I'm indicating where the information will be sent and when on that two-year cycle. So those are the proposed changes to the policy.
And I want to make clear that the draft templates, the example assessment plans, aren't part of the policy change that we're asking you to ultimately approve, although for today this is just a discussion item. The templates are merely an attempt to be helpful and we hope show programs a path forward where assessment isn't necessarily an overwhelming and extremely difficult task to complete. We think that with some planning and organization, it can become something that doesn't have an enormous impact on most faculty members' time. It does require organization and effort on the part of an assessment coordinator within each department or program. And I have spoken with deans about making appropriate workload provisions for that. We can't really say it's going to be that amount of workload because programs differ in size and complexity. The ones that have specialized accreditation with quite elaborate assessment requirements, that is a very big job for somebody in an area like social work or engineering that has those, or education that has some of those specialized requirements. On the other hand, if one has a small program and is using the simplest possible assessment plan, it's a lesser task, although one that's still important to carry out. So the educational effectiveness policy is simply the text about assessing educational effectiveness with the particular change on the frequency of submission of the reports and that's what we're putting to a Senate vote. The assessment plans, as I said, are a suggestion, intended to be a helpful suggestion. If, as we go forward, we find that many programs want to adopt it, I think it will lead to more consistency and also an easier path toward carrying out assessment across the university, because if all of the departments in your particular unit are doing it much the same way, I think there's some synergy and some ways that you can cooperate to make it easier for everyone.
Provost, what's your best estimate about the time that it might take to do the assessment, like program like ours, the engineering program?
Well, I'm not probably as familiar with the ABET accreditation assessment as you are working directly in engineering. My impression is that the ABET accreditation effort probably would benefit from a staff member who part-time supported it to do some of the information collection and organization, and probably in each department at least one workload unit for a faculty member per department to carry it out. But your dean is the best person to assess that, and please don't mark down that the provost contradicted what the dean said.
Well, in my view, we are spending more time assessing ourselves than at least, you know, teaching the students. And this is, I'm telling you, after 30 years at this campus.
Mm-hmm.
That's primarily your specialized, though. That's much heavier than the institutional one.
The ABET accreditation requirements are elaborate and somewhat time-consuming. I think an average department with the simplest acceptable assessment plan could manage to carry it out with the amount of time, which is about a week that one workload unit represents. Larger departments and more complicated assessment efforts can definitely require more. This emphasis on assessment is definitely taking time. There's only so many hours in the day, so you have to squeeze it out of some other part of your effort. It's not something that Dana and I would have invented specifically to consume more of your time, but it is an external requirement, even from some of the specialized accrediting organizations as well as from our general accrediting organization, and therefore it's something that we need to do. I'll also add that it actually does, and a number of programs have recognized this, provide useful information. It's caused quite a few programs and written in their assessment reports to look carefully, for instance, at students' writing abilities, realizing that they're not very good at all, and the CORE will probably be paying attention to some of that feedback as well, CORE Revitalization Committee. Some programs have identified substantial gaps, like biology in the cell and molecular area, where they really need to fill in with additional courses. So I believe that it is a useful process. That's probably not a great comfort to people that are actually needing to deal with the effort and the paperwork, but it's something that can help us to improve our programs and make them better. It also can help us to demonstrate our value to external constituencies and show what we are accomplishing for our students.
Tony?
I have a question. Is it on?
Yeah.
I have a question about the preparing for career assessment aspect. So many students, even graduate students, but certainly undergrads, don't actually move immediately into the job that's going to become their lifetime employment occupation. They try different things. They move around. And tracking students after they've gone on, it's probably not going to be sufficient to just track them for 1 year. And it seems to me that this is potentially a tremendous effort to track populations of students over the long term. If this is going to become an important aspect, which certainly sounds as if this is becoming more important to both accreditors and the legislature, is there some possibility that the central sort of statistical unit of the university could take charge of tracking students rather than having it fall to the individual departments and units?
So we're actually looking into, can the Alaska Department of Labor provide some information about our graduates? So that's one of the things we're investigating, so to ease that. I will say, you know, for some programs, they face the problem you've described. I came out of the statistics program, and we know where every one of our graduates that ever graduated with a master's degree is now and what they're doing. So there are programs like that. Chemistry is one of those. There are others around. And so we included that because it's something fairly common for programs to keep. Now, not all are doing that, and for some programs it would be very challenging. There's no question. But it forms a good example.
Bill?
Dana, you've talked about this before, but maybe you could just kind of give a brief summary of the rationale for moving from the four-year cycle to the two-year cycle.
So two key reasons. First, it's clear to every department chair who's elected for 2 years that they have a responsibility for assessment. In the four-year cycle, that's not the case, right? Okay. And the other one is we're on a seven-year accreditation cycle. All right, and we want to be able to demonstrate a periodic implementation of assessment. And so that's the motivation for going to a two-year. All right, I want to explain a little bit further about the Commission's view on this. We did an excellent job of assessing our assessment, okay? Perhaps too good of a job, but I'll take blame for that. We were able to tell them what proportion of our programs use a direct measure of student learning, which are only using an indirect measure, such as a survey, just asking a student's opinion about their learning. What proportion could demonstrate improvement in their curriculum resulting from outcomes assessment? You get the idea. The one that they picked on was, we made a statement, 60% of our programs are able to demonstrate improvement of the curriculum as a result of their outcomes assessment process. Right? They said that was far too small. Right? Part of our feedback was many of our programs are small. They recognize that. We are small programs. We're reluctant to make a curricular change based on a couple of two, three, four students. We want to accumulate information over time. Right? They effectively said, well, it's your fault. Your programs are too small, too. So,
so they weren't getting any sympathy
at
all.
Yeah, we got no sympathy there at all. They're expecting that curricular improvement to be at a very high rate. In other words, and they don't have to be major changes. You don't have to change the entire curriculum or add a new course or anything like that. It can be, in this one course, we added this one reading assignment to improve this outcome. All right? So it doesn't have to be extremely large things, it just has to be documented. That you're collecting information and you're using that information to improve outcomes.
I think to add a little more specifically to Cecile's question, one thing that they're particularly looking at is evidence of continuous and regular implementation, although that wasn't specifically in the recommendation, it was back farther in the narrative of their site visit report. What they saw in some cases with the voluminous assessment information that we provided with them is that people had only actually gotten around to doing assessment in the last year or two since we started applying the pressure very firmly to get that done. So that isn't good enough. They want to see that we're doing this consistently all the time, not just in a flurry at the last minute shortly before they show up at our door.
Any other questions or comments or discussion on this? Reiner?
Yeah, so the plan is this could come up for a vote next meeting.
Yes.
If you're willing to look all your committee or all your faculty members, your departmental faculty members in the eye and said, yes, I voted for this, then okay. And on the other hand, if you vote no, then Dana and Susan are going to be really upset. So those are going to be our choices, okay? And we'll have to make them next week, or next meeting.
Brian?
Actually, it's not as much that Dana and Susan will be upset as the Northwest Commission. That's our real challenge, is if the Northwest Commission, and we have not yet received our letter from the Commission affirming our accreditation and expect expect that it will have something about assessment as a specific requirement in it. And so this is, so it could be jeopardizing more than their RAT.
Brian, I want to just say that, however, the Northwest Commission is not requiring that we do this on a two-year cycle. They're saying, you guys better do a better job. And Dana and Susan are saying, we think the best way to do this on a better job is to do it on a two-year cycle.
Exactly true.
And we have to be able to prove that we're doing a better job, not just do it.
If we can trust everyone to keep continuous and thorough records of what they're doing in student learning outcomes assessment, from this point forward, we wouldn't be pushing for this two-year reporting requirement. This requirement, in fact, the requirement for student learning outcomes assessment has been around, as Dana pointed out, since the late 1990s. It was reiterated pretty intensively in 2000 and 2005 relative to the last accreditation self-study and the interim report where we had before received a recommendation on assessment. And it still doesn't seem to have caught hold in terms of something that people need to do regularly and routinely and, in addition, keep records of it. I realize that many people are working hard to improve their courses all the time, but unless we record it and can show the evidence to the accreditation people, it doesn't do us any good in that avenue, even though it may do us a lot of good in terms of our student outcomes or their satisfaction with our curriculum. So I'll just point out that I'm not likely to get wrathful over this. For one thing, this is my 30th year here at UAF, and there's always a future there for me. But it really is about you and the university and its success, not about me, about what I want. This is something that I am absolutely convinced that we have to do, and we have to do it well. I'm willing to go to some lengths to try to make it easier, to explain it to you better, to work with you, to get it accomplished. But it is unfortunately, or fortunately maybe, because it's going to help us improve something that needs to get done.
I'll add one more thing to what Reiner said, and that is both the provost and I serve as evaluators for the Northwest Commission, and we go out and look at other universities and what they're doing in assessment. And some of the universities I have evaluated have an annual report on outcomes assessment and can demonstrate 5 years of their assessment process. So state universities, just like us, you know, are demanding more than what we're asking of this group.
Ben?
My experience is that the more reports you have, the less substantive they become and the more cut and paste that there is. Have you considered using maybe more of a carrot incentive? Instead of mandating everybody do this twice as often, a few years ago we adopted a 60% tuition sharing, right? Perhaps we could, I know deans are very responsive to monetary reward structures, and I would expect that if you maybe adopted a sliding scale that to get the full 60% tuition sharing, you must have adequate records kept, and if it... Yeah, no, it is. But I think that would be probably a lot more effective means of getting things. Maybe drop it down to a 50% cost sharing if they don't adequately document the assessment records.
Friendly question. Why are you starting with 60 and not simply say, hey, if you do this right, we'll give you 65?
That could be.
Oh.
100, what the hell?
But in essence, to use that structure that you've already got in place to reward the deans, because that's where the control is. The control is in the dean's office. And if you give them the right incentive, I'm sure they will get their department heads in line.
Before any more of those wonderful ideas can come out, it's about time for a break. Let's go ahead and reconvene in 5 minutes, and so take a break. We had five. Yeah. Yes, we only had a 5-minute breakdown. There'll be quick public comment. Often we get none, and then yes, you're up.
It could be 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sitting across the aisle with my dean thinking, no, he can't make me do anything.
So I don't know if that means I'll be going to her future in her stead, or if she's going to continue to go and I'm just going to write reports, or I don't know.
But, you know. Although we have to watch out for
look
at the accreditation report that come out.
Oh, here's one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just Dana Found out of last year showing, well, they said
there are
appendix showing.
Three plates in the back of the
So in other words, there's a problem with Dean.
I don't know. Okay.
In
the hallmark it says, look at appendix and door plate.
But if we get into outcomes assessment show,
negative impact.
So
the homework on this thing.
Wow, your program is
You know, I look at
their
database.
The effective way. Although there's a price for that, a lot of the bottom students have ones that can't
not exactly. And that's why it says Appendix 3 then. Oh, 3 then is because
then
it really was changed
to
Appendix 3, and so the problem is the homework, I think.
But the only thing I can't change, I can't change the PDF because I don't have the original.
Right. And like you said,
okay.
It's clear whether we really need to do that, it's not the homework that needs to be changed. Thank you.
Science and engineering, if they want journals, they use books. But I rarely get it. Nobody
and that's what we get
ringing
yeah.
my phone to get books.
Yeah.
Ringing my phone to get $1,000.
I don't know, you know.
Well,
that's how to get
it. So that's why, part of why.
Well, for you, but yeah, I'm glad.
Well, I mean, for me,
what
meta,
you
know, maybe it's just the opposite. You know? I mean, the good information, you know, there's stuff in general, but you can make it into a monograph.
Yeah. So I just wanted to say that I don't blame her for it.
That's right.
But,
you wrote me during the holidays,
yeah.
Not a spark yet.
Yeah.
And I actually went and did all of their homework, working with, whereas maybe the train system.
In fact,
got buried on my desk while I was working on a budget, a grant proposal.
Okay. The latest stuff that's been submitted.
So I have it. I just didn't get it. But it's way too late.
They'll sell us. We can wait until
you know, you were looking for it.
What they've just.
You mean wait as I dug out?
Yeah.
Grant proposal. Oh, is it really that much?
Well, I'm glad you finished your grant proposal.
I wanted you to see that.
Figured you did, and something happened, and we just circumvented it. Said, okay, let's just take things to the master that look interesting to you, and let's worry some other time about what you're going to have to do to finish the grant.
So you'll be getting that interesting change in book.
Oh, hot damn. Thank you.
The other thing is, you had raised
what I've been doing. I mean, I went
that most assessment goes on.
And I always kind of thought, I'll just put it on this and look there for a problem that we go in and just kind of course revise the next.
We have, you know, the answer is more download.
Yes,
it is. And thanks for, I mean, basically this is all about me throwing a hissy fit, okay? I mean, we should have passed it in the last curricular affairs meeting, and I just felt like,
Japanese
okay, and I'm over that now, and we'll pass it next
next meeting, it'll come up, and, you know. And
Paul Lehrer came up and he said, you guys really sold this badly. He said, right now, most programs are collecting information every year.
I don't know. What only happens is they
go, oh my gosh, so you're doing
more
class?
Whereas the books that were 50 years old,
okay.
Which you know, I look at the policy in Poland every 4 years, it's glued in that one too, so I agree.
Thank you. Thank you.
So you aren't tied to come here. Okay?
Wireless mic. They're going to move some of the tubes around in between. So the seating will be a little different, but you're, and I think they're going to have a podium for you for the big demo.
I'm not pushing. We do that. We do that as part of our program.
Otherwise, it'll be simple.
A few days, a week, a couple weeks old.
Besides that, they recognize it takes time, okay? You know, nothing can be done without time. Avoid that time they would put in. Are they going to take a class out of my schedule? You know, what we do.
There's
a lot of work that we've put in.
I
just got an example.
And I wonder,
It is tailored to your location. Yeah. So what you get and what your brother in New York gets.
You know what? I haven't.
One of the founders that move on.
I think she's coming in. Yeah.
And Ken Thomas, both teams,
need that for a whole hour.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, maybe from Los Angeles, you can have a Fairbanks, you can
have
a
regular, maybe it would be.
Get the show back on the road. Yo! Seats, everyone, please. All right, before we get a chance to see our guest speaker, we've got some time here for public comments, questions. Is there anyone from the public who wants to address the Faculty Senate? Seeing none, that moves us on to our guest speaker, Jennifer. All right, everyone, I'm glad you are here. We have a guest speaker in town. This is Dr. Claudia Lantman. She is here as a guest of the UAF Faculty Senate, and her visit is a collaboration between the Senate and the two faculty unions, United Academics and UAFT.
back up. Dr. Lantman is here for today and tomorrow. If you'd like to speak with her, please either contact her directly or you can find her through Kathy or me or Jane Harvey. She is a professor of psychology at the University of Alaska Anchorage, PhD from Loyola University of Chicago. She's been studying this topic of contrapower aggression in academia since 2005, and we've invited her here to tell us about her research and discuss this topic with the faculty at UAF. So the intended audience is you, the faculty. Please feel free to bring up questions and discussion points. The end of this session, she's going to do a brief summary of this here at the Faculty Senate meeting. We've allotted 15 minutes for this. And then she will have an hour and a half full seminar. That will start at 3:30 here in the same room. So the Faculty Senate meeting ends at 3. We do a quick changeover of the table configurations. And then her seminar starts at 3:30. It will end at by 5 o'clock. If you can't stay all the way, please stay for as much as you can. The latter part of the seminar will be a discussion. So without any more ado, Dr. Claudia Lantman.
Well, thanks for having me. I always start this talk off saying I really love my job. I love my students. I've been at UAA for 20 years and could talk for days about all of my students' accomplishments, but those are not the students I'm going to be talking about today. A couple weeks ago, my husband was giving a talk, and he said that for psychologists, research is me-search, and that most of us are trying to figure out something about our own lives, something important in our lives, and there is absolute truth to that here. I started researching this about 10 years ago when I had a really horrible experience. I had a student who was threatening me and bullying me. I was really scared. I didn't tell anyone. I thought it might reflect poorly on me. I was, at that point, I don't think I had tenure even. I was, kind of terrified to go to my classroom. I was receiving lots of threatening messages from this guy, and it started to wear on me. I didn't want to go to work. I was walking around the hallways scared. And so I went to the library and said, who's done research on this? Is this happening anywhere else? And I couldn't find anything but anecdotal stuff. So I started talking to my colleagues, and I found out that this was happening to other people, both men and women, but seemed to be having a bigger influence on women. So I did the first study in 2005. I surveyed every single faculty member on our campus. About 75% of them responded, and I think that should tell you something right there, that people had something to say. And then I followed that up with, I asked them, have you had a really bad experience, and if so, would you talk about it? And about 50 said they did. I interviewed all 50. They were supposed to be interviews. They turned into therapy sessions. They were very long, and there was a lot of crying and a lot of tears from the women. What I found is that both men and women talked about the same kinds of things happening to them, but it had a different effect on women. And I was really interested in studying this further, so I got a sabbatical a few years back and decided to do a big national study. And that's what I'm going to talk about in the meeting this afternoon. And I'm going to hit the highlights here. I'm going to give you guys just some of the data to skip the background and go strictly to the data. As Jennifer said, this is called contrapower harassment. That's the term that's used to describe sort of globally incivility, aggression, violence, bullying, threatening behaviors, sexual harassment from students to faculty. So it's called contrapower because it kind of goes backwards, that we're the ones who are supposed to have the power. So how is it that somebody who has less power can bully or threaten somebody with more power? So Recent research that I'll talk quite a lot about later this afternoon suggests that this is happening really early. The APA did a huge study recently that showed that elementary school teachers are reporting counterpower harassment. You know, bullying is a regular part of our culture. There's research that shows that half of all high school students said not only have they been bullied in the last week, but they've bullied somebody else, most of it online. So the culture of bullying and incivility starts really early. I'm just going to start, I always start this talk out with a little bit of the qualitative data from this survey, and then I'll tell you a little bit more. And this will give you a sense of the kinds of things I'm interested in. So these are actual responses from this national study where faculty were asked to describe their worst experience if they had one with counterpower harassment. So on the low end, called me a bitch, one threw his bag on the ground and started screaming. That's kind of the low end. Throwing insults at me in class, like I'm not learning shit in this class, waste of money, etc. The student referred to me as a whore in class. Those were really mild ones. Accused me of discrimination, lied about my behavior, shouted repeatedly at me in class, threatened grievances. Accused me of favoritism and damaged my car while at work. I've had my car damaged several times in the past 20 years. She asked me if this was a class that she needed to lay the teacher to get an A. Threats of harm to me, my family, and to slash my tires. Threatened me, wrote a note on the final test on what would happen if I didn't give him the desired grade. I didn't write that one. I could have written that one. That's where I started. And student made the comment that if he was not admitted to the nursing program, that he would just take a gun and blow everyone away. Okay, so this is just a little random sample of the kinds of things that professors wrote about. This was from those who said they'd had a really bad experience. So I just want to give you now a little overview of how I sampled for this study and where the data is coming from. So my goal was to get a random sample of U.S. professors. So I used this accreditation website to get a list of all colleges and universities that offered at least a four-year degree. So community colleges, vocational schools were not included in this study. So that was about 1,900 and 14. So that was the sampling frame. About 68% were private, 32% public. I wanted it to be a representative sample, so I stratified, and I wanted to see if there were any differences between public and private. There weren't, very few. I'll give the one exception in a moment. So I stratified, and then I took a random sample of 100 schools, and then from those 100 schools, I went and got from their websites an alphabetized list of all faculty, and then I randomly selected 8 faculty. I oversampled a bit in case some were returned, and I was able to get both faculty members' address at work and their email address, so I sent them a survey. 66% of them responded, about 70% of women responded. So it's higher response rate for women, but that's actually pretty much the case in all survey research, so not too surprising. And I ended up with a final sample size of 524 faculty members. So just to hit some of the highlights I'm going to talk about this afternoon, I used a measure that I originally designed for the UAA study, modifying it to ask about how many times something had happened in the past year. So this is a big graph with a lot of data on it, but you can get the point really quickly that I would like to make. These are ordered from most frequent to least frequent, and what I've put up here is the percent reporting that this student behavior happened at least once per year. I also have the actual number of times per year each faculty member said it happened in the last year. So you can see it's ordered from the least kind of severe stuff, incivility. Did students engage in distracting non-class conversations or request you make your tests easier? Show disdain or disapproval, like grunting or groaning during class? continually interrupting you. As we move down this list, the behaviors become less uncivil and more bullying, demanding makeups or extensions that are not usually offered, inappropriate or hostile course evaluations, questioning your credentials. And as we get down to the bottom, hostile or threatening comments in class, yelling or screaming at you, accusing you of racism, sexism, or sexual harassment in response to an undesired grade, or an outright threat or intimidation. So what you can see is at the top, you know, pretty much everybody said that's happened at least once in the past year, and most people said it happened several times in the past year. When you get down to the bottom, it's only about 1 in 10. But the thing that you can notice from this graph is that the pink bar for women is a lot bigger than the pink or the green bar for men. That on an incivility bullying index where I added up the total number of times each of these things happened in the past year, the total for women was about 16, and it was much higher, significantly higher than it was for men, which is about 11. So one of the things, I'm a gender researcher, that's what I'm interested in. I wanted to see what predictors, gender and otherwise, would predict who is more likely to be the victim of incivility and bullying. And this sort of quick diagram here, I don't have actual correlations up here since this is a pretty short presentation, but these are all significant predictors. Being a woman, being younger, being a minority, being without tenure, not having a PhD, being of lower rank, and having fewer years of teaching. I can tell you that if you put it all in one big multiple regression equation, only four of them remain statistically significant predictors because they suck up some of the same variance. But you wouldn't probably be surprised to know that they're the four that students obviously know. So being a woman, being younger, being a racial or ethnic minority, and not having a PhD. Those are the four big predictors in an equation, because I think that makes sense. They're the ones people know about. They don't know about your tenure status. They don't know about some of those other things. Later, I'll talk a little bit about sexual harassment in the other presentation. Here, I just wanted to talk about some of the most serious kinds of student aggression. Mm-hmm.
Do you want questions throughout, or should we hold them?
Up to you. Go ahead.
Which one was the biggest predictor out of the four?
Oh, gender by far. Huge, yeah. It's definitely gender. Yeah, gender throughout, actually, although when we talk about sexual harassment in the later presentation, it's men who get more of it, not women. It's a huge predictor, but it's men, not women. Pardon me? Okay, so this is the really serious stuff. I didn't break this down by gender because it's really small numbers and, you know, mercifully small numbers. You know, 1.4% said they got a death threat or a colleague did. Less than 1% got threatened with physical harm or attacked physically. 2% had their personal or university property damaged. 4.5% were bribed, 1.2% stalked or followed, and only 0.2% used or had a weapon used or threatened to have a weapon used against them. Now, these numbers look really small. There's roughly 650 faculty members at UAF. So if you translate that in a year, that would be 9 would get death threats, 2 to 3 would be threatened with physical harm, 2 to 3 would be attacked, 14 would have their property damaged, 29 would be offered a bribe, 8 would be stalked, 1 would be threatened with a weapon or worse. So they look like small numbers, but I'm not okay with that, any of that. So I'd like to just briefly talk about the negative consequences these kinds of things can have on faculty members. These are quantitative data where all 524 answered these questions. After that, I asked them, have you ever had a significant or serious incident of student incivility, bullying, or aggression in your life? And if so, would you write about it? You saw some of those descriptions at the beginning. I asked them to also say whether or not certain negative consequences occurred as a direct result of that incident, of that one serious incident they were writing about. So this is the list of negative, oh, sorry. skipped one. So 63% of women said yes, and 50% of men. So, you know, more women than men said, yes, I've had a significant incident, but half of all men said they'd had a significant incident as well. So, you know, that is a large number. They differ quite a bit in what those incidences were about, and I'll talk about that later. So in terms of consequences, these are the things that I had asked about in all of the studies I've done, and I've ordered them again in terms of sort of the most common consequence to the least. You know, on the low end, the less severe end, avoiding the student outside of class, avoiding eye contact with the student in class, difficulty sleeping, afraid to be alone in the classroom, productivity at work suffering, didn't want to go to work. If someone had asked this about me the first time this happened to me, the first contra power harassment, I would have checked every single one of these boxes. It was easy for me to make this list because I lived this list, actually, more than one time. I didn't feel like quitting. That's not quite that extreme. But, you know, if you look at this list at the bottom, canceled class because you were so distraught, I did that. It killed me, but I did it. Treated for stress-related illness, went to see a mental health professional. You could see, again, pink bars, way bigger than green bars. And my direct interviews with UAA faculty absolutely showed this same thing. Men and women talking about the same thing happening to them, but women saying, this is derailing me. I am really, really having a hard time with this, and men not having quite as difficult time. And, you know, it's interesting. My husband, John Petratus, is also a faculty member at UAA. We started together. We went to school together. We have the same degree. We teach the same classes. We both have all had these things happen to us. His experience has been different than mine. And I think that that's worth spending some time thinking about. So last bit of data I'm going to throw up here is, what did we do? Well, how do faculty respond to this? One of the positive things that a faculty member can do is seek social support. Women actually seek social support a lot more often than men do. My interviews tell me that that's actually very, very helpful to you to talk about this with colleagues. It's not surprising. I don't think that women are more likely to reach out to people for help. That's consistent with gender roles. But if you look at some of the reporting here, reporting it to your chair is usually the first level. Reporting it to the dean of your college is what people tend to do second. And third, if they get somewhere beyond that, it's reporting it to the dean of students. Only less than one in three reported it to the dean of students. That's the place you need to report it. So one of the things I've learned in all three of these studies is that faculty members do not know what the dean of students' office is for, and that this is the way to report it. Faculty over and over and over told me that they went to see the dean of their college, and what they were told to do was fix it, change the grade, make it go away in some way. Well, why? Well, because the dean of your college is the boss of you, not the boss of the student. You have to go to somebody who can discipline the student, and that's the dean of students. So, you know, I don't have this in the short presentation here, but faculty who do go through the dean of students generally report satisfaction with that. They feel like that's the right route to go. They don't report satisfaction to the same degree when reporting it to the dean of their college or to the chair. 1 in 10 here, you know, basically called the police. And that last one, changed or dropped assignments, I will talk about that later on in more detail. It's one that I feel really strongly about. Women do this a lot more than men, change or drop assignments because of something that happened. I got a big problem with that. We need to change the students' behavior. We don't need to water down our assignments in order to make these problems go away. So personally, that's one that I really work on a lot. So just in a preview of what else I'll talk about this afternoon, you know, this last slide is what seemed to help, because at UAA, this is a part of our culture now. I think part of it is this research that I've been doing. Part of it is the Difficult Dialogues program that we had going on at UAA and APU, funded by the Ford Foundation. It's sort of part of our culture now to understand this and help faculty and students deal with it. Our Center for Advancing Faculty Excellence now puts on, I would say, three workshops a semester just to help faculty, particularly new faculty, deal with this and learn what to do in the classroom and how to make this less stressful. In our department, since I did this research, our undergrad faculty, and I am primarily an undergraduate faculty member, we have a weekly faculty meeting, and we set aside the last 10 minutes of those meetings. We call them mentoring moments. It was designed for younger faculty to ask older, more experienced faculty for help. That's not what it is at all, because I go in there with problems all the time, and I'm one of the elders in the department. But it's a really positive way to share stuff and talk about students who are giving us problems and come up with the best solution. And then as a group, we kind of decide what's the best course of action and when to bring in the Dean of Students. And especially for some of our younger faculty, they don't even know the Dean of Students exists. The last thing I would say is we have an amazing Dean of Students office. They are incredibly supportive. I've had some pretty serious problems with students in my 20 years, and every time I have worked with them, they have helped me, they have helped the student, they have dealt with it swiftly, well. They're very supportive, and they do a great job. But the last point I will make right now is that they cannot help you if you don't report it. And just like with plagiarism and academic dishonesty and other kinds of things, not reporting it, in some ways it suggests to the student that their behavior is okay, but also not reporting it means that there's no track record. And so when they finally get reported to the Dean of Students, it's their first offense instead of their 10th. Later on I'll talk a little bit more about how reporting it is really the key here. So I'm just going to stop there. Yeah.
Couple questions. One, did you collect data on gender and or age of students involved in these incidents?
Yes, and I don't have that in the presentation today because it goes in a different direction, but I can tell you this. The typical perpetrator is an undergraduate male in his early 20s. The typical victim is a woman who teaches mostly undergraduates. Graduate students do account for 15% of it. My impression is that from interviews with UAA faculty, that's some of the most severe stuff that goes on, actually. Did I miss a part of that?
No.
Okay. Yeah, so.
Second question. Do students' threats of self-harm count as harassment here?
Yeah, there were a couple of discussions about exactly that, yes. Somebody wrote about getting suicide notes from a student. So yes, so harassment loosely, used loosely there. Yeah. Yeah.
Have any of the policies at UAA changed as a result of this?
Oh yeah. The literature that the Dean of Students Office puts out now is fantastic, and it has very specific guidelines for if this happens in class, this is what you should do. And they label it as, minor incivility, challenging behaviors, refusing behaviors, and I'll present data on that. I used their guidelines in this research to categorize those open-ended responses. So yes, they have put together really, really good literature. We make sure we get it out to everybody, especially the new faculty, but everybody every year gets it.
Because I know here, and I don't know if this is true in all colleges, but I know of myself and other colleagues who've caught students cheating or plagiarizing, and they don't report it because there isn't enough backup from the university.
Right.
And so one thing I would like to see is, stronger policies on that so that faculty really feel willing to stick their necks out.
Yeah.
So that's kind of why I was asking, you know, have actual policies changed, not just information, but actual policies changed in response to the data?
Yeah, and actually, along with someone from the Dean of Students, I did a survey last year of UAA students and faculty on cheating, their own cheating, and you know, we went into classrooms, GER classrooms, and collected data from about, I think we have about 400 or 500 students. 90% of the students who were handed the survey filled it out, and it the most interesting thing relevant here is that there's a great disconnect between what faculty and students see as cheating, and that I think that contributes to some of this. There is a vast disconnect, which is a big problem.
Deborah?
Yeah, I was interested in, like, repercussions towards students that might have changed, like probation, expelled, academic, I don't know.
Yeah, every case is dealt with on a case-by-case basis. Most students, the best way to deal with this stuff is to get at it as soon as you possibly can, because in my experience and the Dean of Students' experience, Bruce Schultz wrote a great paper on this. He was our former Dean of Students, and now he's Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs. He, and I'll quote him this afternoon, he said, you know, the best thing to do is catch it early, because then it generally stops. That's bringing someone's attention to the bad behavior usually is enough to stop it. If that doesn't, and it goes to the Dean of Students, they deal with it on a case-by-case basis. Expulsion is highly unlikely. Most of the time, they sit down with a counselor, and they work out what the issues are, and they learn what is appropriate and inappropriate behavior. And in my experience, that seems to work really effectively. Yeah. Hi, Joyce.
Florida, can I just take this opportunity to say that at least once a semester, my office has a workshop given by Don Foley, president of our Dean of Students, and all these issues are addressed.
So awesome.
I'm sure that a lot of you haven't seen the beginning of each semester. I highly encourage you.
Yeah.
I think that this is an awesome teaser for Claudia's lecture at 3:30. So think about your questions, encourage your faculty to come, and thank you, Claudia, for the overview, and we look forward to hearing more at 3:30. So with that, let's go ahead and move on to governance reports, staff council tips. You can come grab Susan's, it looks like.
Good afternoon. Let's give a quick update on what staff council has been up to. First semester, we were dealing with a lot of kind of external issues, staff compensation, healthcare, things like that. The second semester looks a lot more internal for us, and I think that's the way it usually goes for each year. We have addressed the tuition waiver benefit and sent a resolution to both Staff Alliance and System Governance saying that we oppose changes to the tuition waiver benefit. We've been talking about smoking and health care and the proposed changes to our health care. We are participating in the listening session that the President is holding next week. Some of us are participating in the strategic planning that the Chancellor is putting forth. As a result of that, we're doing some of our own strategic planning. Most of you probably haven't been to a staff council meeting, but we are much less represented than you are here. A fraction of people attend staff council meetings. We don't have all our seats filled. And Joelle and I are challenging the staff to come up with different ways of being represented. We're asking staff if what we're doing right now is effective, because I see a lot of holes and not good participation. So it's been fun to try to address that, but with few people in the room, it's challenging. So. Staff Appreciation Day is coming up at the end of May, and that's a big deal for one of our committees. They spend tons of time thinking about that and planning. We have an orientation for new staff members and a breakfast with the Chancellor in 2 weeks, and so we're looking forward to having some new bodies at meetings and trying to help them understand how system governance and staff council specifically works to affect change. So I think those are some of the big topics that we have on our plate right now. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Any questions for Pips?
So you guys voted to keep that you wanted the tuition waiver kept as it has been. Is that what you?
Yes.
Yeah. So perhaps we should discuss that in the Senate.
And yeah, Kathy and I have talked a little bit about it through Staff Alliance, and then it actually went on to system governance as a result of requests from the president saying that he'd like to have the request for no change come from system governance. So that's where it sits right now, and I imagine system governance will be forwarding that on.
Yes, it's a system governance passed a motion supporting staff council's recommendation that it remain the same for staff.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Nope. Thank you, Pips.
Thank you.
ASUAS.
Good afternoon. I'm Ann Williamson. I'm the office manager for ASUAS. Mari and Robert couldn't make it today. They're in Juneau at the 27th Annual Student Legislative Conference. So they asked me to read a brief statement to you. Let's see. Currently, we are working on setting up a governance group forum for students this semester involving ASUAF, Faculty Senate, and Staff Council. This forum would help students stay informed on the issues and policies that are being discussed, because we see a big disconnect between students and the rest of UAS in some of those matters. And then some of the recent main concerns of students this semester seem to involve issues with academic advising and the Stay on Track initiative. This past Saturday, Mari and Robert were able to talk to the Faculty Senate President from UAS and the UA Alliance Chair, trying to bring up ways to help students complete their education on time and get more ideas to improve academic advising. So far this semester, there's only been one Senate meeting, but our next meeting will be held on Sunday the 12th in the Alumni Lounge, which is in the Constitution Hall. So just an open invitation. Please don't hesitate to join us and kind of see what we're up to. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to write them down and get them to the appropriate student representative.
Any questions for Ann to take forward? Nope. Thank you very much, Ann. Sorry, Mike.
I was just saying it might be nice to hear from the students when they come back from Juneau, maybe at the next
meeting. Oh, yeah. That's great. Yeah, I'll definitely.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from them. Thank you. UNAC.
I just have a few things. First, I want to explain my presence. I'm acting organizational vice president this semester while Debu Misra is on sabbatical, but he will be back after. I'll be acting through June 30th, and then he'll be back. So if you need anything this semester, I'm the point of contact. In terms of what's been going on more generally or what's going to be going on, with United Academics, most of you are probably aware that the class action lawsuit that United Academics initiated on behalf of ORP Tier 1 members a few years back now is progressing towards settlement. All the class members have been notified, and that's moving along. I plan to hold some membership meetings this semester. The first one will relate to my service. You may know me as one of the United Academics Joint Healthcare Committee representatives. So to tie those couple of things together and talk to people about your preventive care benefits, which is something that I've been hearing have been causing people some grief. Great benefit, a little bit tricky perhaps to actually use it in the way in which people understand and intend it. So look for information to be coming out about that. Also, a general call for volunteers, I guess, is my last thing. Just to let you know that the Representative Assembly is the entire Representative Assembly for United Academics, which is our governing organization, our policy body, is up for election this spring. So you'll be seeing an announcement, a call for people to run here pretty shortly. And if you've not participated in union activity before, you don't necessarily know what that's about, but you have any concerns about how United Academics is running, positive or negative, there's a real commitment on the part of the current leadership to get people trained. So don't let that stop you if you have an interest. And we also have openings on committees in our organizational structure, particularly the membership committee is one where we could use some assistance.
Thank you, Melanie. Any questions? Laura?
Could you just give us some more details on that, what that settlement looked like that you guys are moving towards too?
I didn't come prepared with the details of what the settlement looks like. All the class members have received letters detailing what that looks like. So I can't really elaborate on the details of the settlement.
Cecile?
And as one of the current RA members, we just got back from 2 days of training in Anchorage, and it was excellent training we got. That's it was very useful on a number of areas. We looked at how to read and write contract language, for example, which is useful not just for our own contract, but for other types of contracts we may need to look at more carefully, and other sort of legal issues. So it was very, very useful. So I'm really happy that we're going to be doing more of that, and I hope that more of you will come and that you encourage your colleagues to come. Great information.
Thank you. Doni?
As a member of the Joint Healthcare Committee, can you give us any 30-second updates on what's going on with that for the next year?
Well, the rate-setting meeting is going to come up for employee payroll deductions in just under a month. So there will be more information about what your costs are going to look like for next year at that time. We don't get the numbers on the Joint Healthcare Committee for that until usually at that meeting or a couple of days before it happens, so we don't know yet. You may have been paying attention to the tobacco surcharge that was announced about a year ago. That has been canceled. That's not going to happen. They've decided on an alternate plan that's outside the purview of the Joint Health Care Committee, but they will not be implementing a tobacco surcharge. So that's a significant development that's happened in the last year. And also there will be a couple of announcements coming around shortly about opportunities for wellness activities outside of, partly outside of and partly administered by the WIN program. So one, a group activity for groups of 10 or more who would like to arrange their own wellness activity, and that's pretty broadly construed. There's an application. It's up on the website now, but we haven't gotten the email announcement out. We're working on it. It's in the pipeline somewhere. But anyway, for reimbursement for costs of wellness, and also administered through WIN, but not actually a WIN program, will be an individual level reimbursement. I think we've approved that, and it should be coming out shortly for people who, again, don't necessarily want to participate in some of those group activities, but want some reimbursement. I think up to $50 is what we've talked about for gym equipment and other things that contribute to your own wellness activities.
Thank you. Jane, do you want to do UAFT?
Actually, I was just going to report on the Joint Health Care Committee. And
sorry, Jane.
No, it's great. Thank you.
Any questions for Jane? Thank you. That takes us to members' comments, questions, announcements. Anything we need to know other than the fact Claudia is in about 30 minutes going to be giving us a more in-depth look at the results from her studies? Jane?
The Committee on the Status of Women is presenting a brown bag lunch discussion negotiating with deans on a week from Thursday and the 1 to 2 hour. And there's some notices on the back table, and I have some more here as well. So it should be pretty valuable.
Great. Anything else people want to bring to our attention?
Well, I'll just say briefly, I just got back from Juneau myself. I had students down there for a little over a week, and there's, as one of the panelists, the students met with 26 members of the legislature while they were down there individually. But there's going to be a lot of decisions here over the next few weeks, and as one of the panelists that works, a fiscal analyst for the legislature, said, the decisions of this legislature may affect us all for a decade. So, and it's, if you're interested or concerned about the decisions that are going to be made down there, this is the time to do it, not when they do the statewide hearings. By that time, it's too late. So I would suggest you be involved in this legislative process, from contacting your legislators or
I'll be happy to do a presentation, I guess, at the next legislative, next time we gather, but that's going to be pretty late in the legislative session.
Okay, so what Mike is saying is contact people, and if you've got any questions about the process or how to do that, talk to him.
There's $3.7 billion in surplus, and there's major initiatives to spend a lot of that surplus money, and there's major differences between the House and the Senate on basic programs. So yeah, it's going to be a very contentious and interesting session, I think.
Yep. Thank you very much. Any other questions, comments? Move to adjourn? Second? All right, we're out of here. Thank you, guys.
Run over all year.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, no, it was a bunch of discussion on things.
How are you?
Quite a proportion to what it costs.